Well, there's so much going on in South Africa at the moment, and one of those who's a bit of a lightning rod is Ernst Rutz, social activist, author, and until very recently, very involved in the whole AfriForum solidarity movement. We'll find out more from Ernst today on the controversy that is now surrounding the Afrikaner activist organizations, and they're even being called out for treason. It's quite a fortuitous time that we're getting together and having this conversation, Ernst. And I did try and talk to you when we saw each other in London at the ARC conference, but you had an appointment with someone much more important in Tucker Carlson. So we're going to talk about Tucker Carlson in just a moment, because I think when that interview comes out, it's going to shake the foundations of South Africa. But really, just to pick up immediately where we are, the guys that you know so well, Kali and others from the AfriForum Solidarity Movement who've been in the United States, due to come back home imminently, are now being threatened, in some quarters it appears, with being arrested for treason when they land back in the country. Is this just a bit of social media hype, or is there more to it?
Well, thank you. I don't know how serious we should take threats like that. It is a serious threat, but I'm not sure whether they would follow through. Anything is possible in a country like South Africa, so we'll see what happens. But I do think that this is typically the problem with populism and populist rhetoric in politics, is populism is predicated on the idea that you have to make these outlandish statements in order to get media attention, or in order to sort of cut through the noise and make sure that your message is heard. And it works. If you chant about killing farmers, and if you talk about slitting the throat of whiteness and all of this type of stuff, it actually works because people take note of what you're saying. But the problem with this populist approach is eventually people start losing interest, and then you have to up your game. Then you have to become a bit more populist and a bit more extreme. And so it's a vicious circle, this game of populism. And that's what we're seeing in South Africa. And so these populist institutions and populist politicians cannot now just respond international liaison and this trip to the United States, for example, by saying they disagree. They have to say something that is a bit more extreme than all the other things they have said in order to be taken seriously. And so they come with claims like treason or high treason and arresting people when they arrive at the airport. And perhaps that will happen. I would like to think that it's empty threats, but we'll have to see.
Well, in a perverse way, if they were to do that, it would probably be the best publicity that Kali Creel and others could get, because the international media would suddenly be focused on this paragon of apparent moral virtue called South Africa or the ANC, and it arrests people for expressing freedom of speech. So I'm sure they're not that thick. I'm sure that won't be. Oh, hang on. Can't say I'm sure, because who knows?
Well, the ANC of all institutions should know this. The value for a movement to have a martyr, to have one of your leaders being thrown in prison, at least the propaganda value, and the fact that that does not work to prevent people from hearing your message, it creates the opposite situation. So it would be the ultimate own goal for the government or for some of these leftist movements to try to arrest people who are raising awareness about problems in South Africa, because if they do that, the entire world, or at least those interested all over the world, would immediately take note, would immediately try to find out what is it that these people were arrested for. And then they would find that, oh, actually, these people were just exercising their right to free speech. They were criticizing the government. They weren't planning an armed insurrection, anything to that effect. It wasn't treason by any stretch of the imagination. It was trying to help the country. So I think in terms of if I was a member of the ANC or the government or one of these movements, I would think that the worst thing that you could possibly do in a situation like this is try to arrest your political opponents and try to throw them in jail. It's the single biggest thing that you could do to amplify the message of those you are trying to silence?
You've got an interesting background. You were drawn to activism as a student. You had a look through there during the time that you were at Tikkies. You started the Youth League of AfroForum at that stage. And you have a doctorate as well in an area which is very close to many people's hearts, the, I suppose, self-determination by minorities. And that too gives you not just, we often hear people with rhetoric, but it actually gives you the research background and having done the work into how the Constitution could actually be used or what the Constitution says about these kind of things. So I'm really looking forward to getting your insights on these as we go through this conversation today. But talking about treason and talking about maybe a far, far bigger platform than those that Kali Creel and co had, you were on Tucker Carlson's show. Are you worried now, given this rhetoric that's coming through from the ANC and its supporters, and particularly in social media, that you might also be accused of treason when that interview comes out, which is imminent as well?
Yes. Well, in terms of my own approach and personality, you could say, I'm very stoic. So threats of being arrested and accusations of treason, these type of things, you know, all these slurs that you hear in public discourse about being a racist. On the one hand, you get accused of being a racist, and on the other hand, you get accused of being a traitor. I've gotten used to it to a large extent, and I'm not really too concerned about that. And I have to be honest, and I'm not trying to create an image of being brave or anything to that effect. But the idea of someone coming after you for having allegedly committed treason when you know that isn't true doesn't really scare me. It's not something that keeps me awake at night. In fact, it's in our current situation in South Africa, accusations like those should be regarded as a badge of honor, and it should be regarded as an indication that you are on the right track. Now, as far as the interview with Tucker Carlson is concerned, it was quite hard-hitting, and I do foresee that it will be something that people will talk about for a while, because I mean, you know, Tucker Carlson, he goes straight to the point. And so he spoke, that's how the interview started, was about the nature or the character of the ANC. And also in terms of the People's War, you know, the political violence before 1994, we spoke about that. We spoke about the race laws. We spoke about corruption. We spoke about the fact that the political system in South Africa is not sustainable, and that the only real way to get some form of harmony or some form of a more sustainable dispensation is to decentralize political power in South Africa. And that's something that we also spoke about, the fact that the United States was involved in putting up this system that we currently have, as a result of which the United States has a moral responsibility to be involved in some way to correct this. This is something that Tucker Carlson vehemently or very strongly agrees with. So I'm sure there would be quite a reaction to the interview when it comes out, which, as you say, is imminent. It might be today or tomorrow.
Well, and millions of people watch his interviews on X and YouTube. So it's certainly going to be very well consumed around the world. But let's just get back into your own motivation. What is it that drew you to becoming an activist? There you are, minding your own business, you're at university, you decide then to become involved, and your whole life since then has been focused in this area. Why?
Well, I've been dreaming about that since high school, and when I went to university, we had this opening day, you know, where all these, you know, this the first year students are welcomed at the University of Pretoria, this was. And there are all these different booths with different student societies and so forth. And I wasn't really interested in the academics or my degree as much as I was interested in activism. So literally before my first day at university, in other words, on the opening day, I immediately went to the different student societies to see which of them are there that sort of resonate with me, where I can become a member, where I can be involved. I've never really been interested in party politics. But if your question is, why was I so interested in this? I think it has to do with my upbringing. Even though I live in Pretoria, and I've been living in Pretoria or Centurion for a few decades, I still would like to believe that I'm a plaas jaapie or a farm boy. I grew up in a town, in the town of Tzaneen, and as a child, I remember, you know, watching the news about what was happening in Zimbabwe. And Tzaneen is also a town, an agricultural town, with a lot of farm attacks and farm murders, to the extent that people I knew growing up were attacked. Some of them were killed and some of them were severely injured, paralyzed and so forth. So I grew up with that reality I also lived on a farm for a while. So I remember at night lying in bed and then a branch would fall from the tree and you think, oh, there's someone outside who's coming to kill us. And it's a very harsh reality for a teenager to live in. But I think that sort of awoke something in me that I need to be involved with this type of thing. So immediately from my first day at university, I was involved with activism in some form.
Now, the whole story of farm murders is incredibly emotive. There are people in government who say, but there's lots of murders happening in South Africa. Why are you focusing so much attention on farm murders? It's a bit of a silly argument, I guess, because you should be stopping all murders and not saying, well, it's not as bad as one or the other. But is this what motivated you, given your background, to put so much attention on farm murders, which clearly is a very, it will hit hard in a country like the United States, who where people could also relate to these kind of issues?
I would say that the reality of farm murders for me was secondary in my motivation. It was a very important part of my motivation. As I said, I grew up with that experience. I also remember on the farm, you know, in the middle of the night, the power goes off and then it was someone stealing the cables, but we didn't know if someone was, you know, cutting something to invade the farm or something. So that certainly played a big role. But I have to be honest, I think the thing that played the biggest role is I grew up quite conservatively. Very Christian, religious, very, very pro community and pro Afrikaner. So I grew up in a very not a very political family, but a very cultural family. So we went to almost the Afrikaans equivalent of the Boy Scouts. I went on camps like that when I was in primary school and high school, and I've always been fascinated by history and culture and tradition and these things from a very, very young age. And so the farm murders to me was a symptom of the fact that the community of which I'm a member is under attack. And that I had this deep feeling that I need to do something to protect my community or to protect my people. And so I think that and the farm murders for me was a physical manifestation of the problem. And also as an Afrikaner growing up in the new South Africa, you know, we were the number one villains in the country. And there was a time when you couldn't call yourself an Afrikaner. And when the idea of being an Afrikaner was very tainted by the AWB and extremist groups on the right, to the extent that it's a bit better now. But a few years ago, if you went on Google and you searched the word Afrikaner and you clicked on images, you only saw pictures of Eugene Terblanche and Barend Strydom and Boeremag and this type of things. And that really bothered me because I associate with that word, but that's what people think when they hear that word. And so I was very much motivated by the idea of doing something for my community and also trying to, in a sense, rehabilitate the community of which I'm a member. And that sentiment or drive or motivation on the one hand, but then on the other hand, taking note of what was happening in Zimbabwe, taking note of the farm murders and so forth, that just gave me personally the extra motivation to do what I'm doing now on a full-time basis.
You've also been spreading the message internationally for some time, not just in the last few weeks where we've seen a massive result of Donald Trump looking at South Africa with a very different set of glasses to the one that his predecessor looked at it. Where did that idea come from? When did you decide that, well, the only way that we're going to get our community's struggles respected or heard is outside of the country, not in it?
Well, I have an interesting story about that. The first time I went to America was in 2012. It was for AfriForum to register AfriForum with the United Nations as an NGO with, as they call it, special consultative status. And so the process is very simple, and AfriForum complied with all of the criteria. And I was struck by the extent of politics at the United Nations, because it's supposed to be a shoe-in, but it wasn't a shoe-in because there was so much politics involved with the committee that's supposed to see if you comply with the requirements to be regarded as an NGO with special consultative status at the UN. And so the South African government there took active steps to prevent us from registering. And the way they did that was simply to filibuster, as they say in America, just to keep talking until we run out of time. And then they say, oh, sorry, come back next year. But something at that meeting in 2012 really stuck with me to this day, which is someone came to me after I spoke at this conference, trying to convince the members of the meeting to allow us to be registered. And it was a very senior official working at the United Nations. He called me to the side and he said to me, with all due respect, but I don't think what you are trying to do is going to work. And I asked him, what does he mean? And he said that you must remember that South Africa has been for quite some time the poster boy of the United Nations. It's the single biggest success story that the United Nations and people at the United Nations like to boast about. And he said to me that some of us can see, and remember that was 2012, that was what, 13 years ago? Some of us can see that the cracks are showing, but we don't want to talk about those cracks. And if you try to put focus and attention on those cracks, you're not going to get an audience. And it was very discouraging, but in a sense, it had the opposite effect on me personally. It really motivated me to say, well, we need to keep talking about these cracks, not to just to badmouth the country, but to try and fix it, to try and get attention on the problems, because you can't fix a problem if you're in denial of the existence of the problem. And so that statement that some of us know that the cracks are showing, but don't talk about it because you're not going to succeed, for me personally, was a big motivation to be much more involved on the international stage in raising awareness.
And how much time have you spent on that?
Well, a lot. It was one of my core focuses at AfriForum for the last few years I was there. The last year and a half, I would say, I was at the Solidarity Movement as head of policy, where international liaison was also focused. I've spent time in America almost every year since 2012, spent some time in the Netherlands, in Hungary. I attended a conference at Perth where a colleague of mine spoke about farm murders. So international awareness has been a core focus of my activities. And I said to my wife the other day, it's strange how I almost have more friends in other countries than I do in South Africa. Because networking is key. That's the most important part of international liaison and reaching out. And you want to have meetings with people, with serious people, researchers, politicians, journalists, and so forth, about what's happening in the country and how you think it could be corrected. But you also want to go out and have a beer with some people. And I'm very blessed to have been able to do that for quite some time. And it's something that I really enjoy, and I can honestly see that I experience that we are making progress. Looking back from where we were in 2012, when that person said to me, "No one wants to hear you. No one will give you an audience," to where we are now, the progress is very tangible, and that's very fulfilling.
You called Tucker Carlson your friend, or you did in a X note that you put up there. When did you, or how did you?
Well, I mentioned earlier the importance of networking, and I think that's also the most important thing that led to my relationship, and I would say friendship with Tucker, and I'm sure he would agree. It was meeting people, expanding our network, And, you know, meeting with people in Washington, for example, talking about what's happening in South Africa. And then you would ask, well, who do you think we can speak with? Who can you connect us with? How can you help us to broaden our network? And one thing led to the other. And eventually I got to someone who says, well, I don't know Tucker Carlson that well. He was still at Fox News, but I have spoken with him in the past. So I'm going to send him a message and encourage him to speak with you. And then that's how I got to him. And that was in 2018. And I've seen him a few times since then. I've had dinner with him. And I think he's very much out there speaking about a whole big variety of issues. And so he's the type of person about whom people have very strong opinions. Most people I encounter with are very, very supportive of him. And obviously also gets criticism. But my personal experience is that he's phenomenal. I think one of his strengths is the fact that he's very social. He's really interested. You can see when he asks you a question, you can just see on his expression and in his eyes that he's really, really interested in knowing what the answer is. And I think one of his strengths is that he's very well read, even though he doesn't necessarily look like a public intellectual. He looks like a guy that goes fishing and so forth. People will see that in my interview with him that will be published soon. At one point, he said, maybe a quarter into the interview, he said, okay, let me tell you what I think I know about South Africa. And then you can correct me where I'm wrong. And then he starts talking and he talks about the different communities, the different cultures. He talks about the history. He talks about the sizes of the different groups in South Africa. He speaks with a lot of authority and with a lot of general knowledge. And I think that's his strength.
Power of reading and understanding better that way around. So what is it that you want to achieve? Give it to us in a nutshell. We have got people on all sides of the spectrum, some of them who say you're the Antichrist, other people who say, well, you're the opposite of that. What is it that you would like to see happen here?
I'm going to... So currently I'm sort of tongue-in-cheek. I like to say currently I'm unemployed because I'm in the process of starting a new initiative, which will, if all goes well, be announced also within the next few days. But the elevator pitch or the short version, if the question is what's the end game? And I have to be very, very succinct and to the point. I think the end game is to get a better political system for South Africa or a better political dispensation. And what I mean by that is the problems that we experience in South Africa go much farther than having the wrong person as the president or having the wrong party in government. I think if one of the opposition parties were to take over, the party that whoever watching this voted for in the last election, I'm pretty sure if they expect that the things that annoy them and frustrate them about the situation in South Africa would be solved if the party they voted for takes over, they would be disillusioned. And I think more and more people are waking up to this idea that the problem is a bit more deeply rooted. And the core, when I say a different political dispensation, the core of it is a more decentralized system, a system that doesn't give the president and the ruling party as much power as they have, and a system that gives people on ground level much more input, a much bigger say in how they are governed, a system that is more accountable and so forth. That to me, if I had to choose an end game, it would be for people to be much closer to, or much more involved in the way they are being governed.
It's an interesting point you make there. In a recent conversation I had with Dr. Franz Cronier, he was saying that he is now putting a very high chance of the balkanization of South Africa, reminding us that it's a very young country, 1910. When the Union of South Africa was created. And there was a lot of opposition to that at that point in time anyway. And my goodness, if you go to parts of the Western Cape and you then go up to parts of KwaZulu-Natal, where I'm from, those are very, very different communities that you would struggle to say that they are part of the same nation. So I guess that is the question. Are you looking for that kind of result, or indeed, do you think that there is an alternative to that kind of result where what we have as a union gets split up?
that could be a result. And I know to talk about balkanization or secession is a form of heresy, but it's not necessarily the only result. And so my concern here is not to attach myself to one particular outcome, but what I would like to spend much more time on is being involved with research and speaking publicly about different scenarios or different potential outcomes. And so one, if we say the country must be more decentralized, one way to do this would be to split, break up the country. And it's not that unreasonable because since 1910, we can count them. I think South Africa has had 5 constitutions. And it's very standard for a constitution to be in place for 2 decades or so and then being replaced with something else. Of course, the constitution that we have could be replaced with something that is much worse, and that's something that we should be cautious of as well. But other forms, before I say what I want to spend time on, because this will give some context, other forms of decentralization could be something like territorial autonomy. In other words, it's still one country, but different areas within the country have a much bigger degree of autonomy or are more involved with how they are being governed. They have a bigger say on how their tax money is spent. So it's a much more decentralized system. And there are many examples of that. I think the famous, or at least the example that I know best, is South Tyrol, a province in Italy that is predominantly German-speaking province. And if you go there, it's a German cultural community, but it's part of Italy. But they decide how to spend 80 or 90% of their tax money. They have a particular, they can, their culture can flourish even though they are part of Italy. Another form of decentralization could be what they call cultural autonomy, which means that people don't necessarily live in one area, but different communities have, for example, the authority, have their own mini parliaments, and you might call it something else, that have the ability to make laws that are applicable to them. For example, the Afrikaans community or Afrikaner community, however you want to define it, can have the authority to make laws that are applicable to their schools, to schools that teach in Afrikaans, something like that. That's another form. And then another form of decentralization could be a federation like the United States with different states and a central government or a federal government. And so there are many forms. Another form would be to have more explicit group rights or minority rights in the constitution, because technically South Africa doesn't have minority rights, only individual rights. So there are many forms that this could take place, and this is something that I want to spend a lot more time on in future, doing research on what the worst case scenarios could be, or being involved with such research and talking about this, and how to prepare for that. How could things become worse? But also, how could things become better? And if we want, let's say we want to move towards a federation, how do we achieve this? Are there examples in the world where, or in history, where people have done this? How did they do this? And I think in that sense it's very exciting, the time that we're moving in South Africa, because there's a lot of pressure, there's a lot of extremism, but there's also a lot of talk about finding a solution. And I think this aspect of the discussion is very, it doesn't get the attention that it deserves. And that's something that I intend to work on much more in the future.
And how much appetite would there be for that from, in particular, the ANC?
That's a good question. I think there would not be much appetite for that. The ANC works, much appetite for decentralization in particular. The ANC works according to the ideology that as much power should be centralized in the government as is possible. But then they also work according to the strategy of the balance of forces and considering what can you do with the power that you have and how strong are the winds of change against you. And so I think an important part of this discussion ought to be, and this is something I know that AfriForum and the Solidarity Movement has been focusing on a lot, building strong, resilient communities and having a what you could call a power base, as opposed to just having good arguments. I'm very, very much convinced of the fact that you're not going to win a debate like this with good arguments. The people you are arguing with are not interested in good arguments. They are interested in power. So good arguments are important, especially for example, the international community. It's important for credibility, but I don't even think it's 50% of what we ought to do. I think the most important part of what we ought to do is what you could call lobbying, networking, reaching out to people, gaining tangible support, and building strong and resilient institutions. And if we do that, then I think our position in terms of negotiating or pushing for a better future or a better system is much better.
You have had addresses previously where you talk about we've got to do it for ourselves. It's something maybe that the penny's starting to drop in Africa as a whole, that we cannot rely on this continent, on the rich North continuing to provide aid. And we're seeing some very obvious examples here in South Africa. But how do you take your community and the community that you're closest to, the Afrikaner community, and how do you do it for yourself? We've seen the state proofing, and that is certainly taken off all over for very good reason, because you can't rely on Pretoria for a lot of the stuff that you perhaps thought you could. But how do you take it to the next level where you get that greater autonomy? Give us some insight into the way of taking control for your own future.
Well, I read once that Rupert Murdoch was accused of not having compassion with Africa, to which he replied that the problem is not that he doesn't have compassion. The problem is that he has compassion fatigue. And what he meant by that, and I didn't hear him say that, but what I gather from that is that you can help people in a continent and different nations and so forth, but at some point they need to help themselves. And I think the most important part of convincing others that you need their help is first and foremost showing that you can do things for yourself. You can find your own solutions. And so the type of help that we can get from abroad should not be to solve our problems on our behalf, but it could be tangible policies or actions to strengthen the solutions that we are already working on. And again, the most important way to do this is to build institutions. And so I am very Tocquevillian in my approach, with reference, of course, to Alexis de Tocqueville, who wrote Democracy in America in the 1830s. And I think the Afrikaner people are very Tocquevillian, although many Afrikaners haven't read Tocqueville or don't know who he was. But the reason why I say that is he traveled America in the 1830s. He went there to study the penal system shortly after the French Revolution. And he discovered, and to write a report about this, but he discovered that there are some things about America that's more important, some things developing in America that's more important than the penal system, and that's democracy in America. And what he meant by that is that the Americans he discovered of the 1830s, we can argue whether that's still applicable today, had a very, very strong sense of finding your own solutions to the problems that you are faced with. And it was very rural. There was a central government with very little practical authority or power. If a community figured that they need a school, they didn't write to the government and ask the government to build them a school. They got together in the town hall that they have built themselves, and they had a meeting, and they said, guys, we need a school. What are we going to do? And they made a plan on how are they going to build a school for themselves, and how are they going to, who among them are going to be teachers? And that's just one example. Then we have other examples of similar institutions, whether it's social clubs, whether it's ways of maintaining law and order and so forth. And so the fact is that what made America great, according to Tocqueville, what would make America great, and I think what did make America great, was this very, very strong resolve of fixing your own problems and building your own institutions, believing in what they call the American dream, and believing that the way to achieve this is to roll up your sleeves and work hard and be involved with your community. And I do think, and I'm very proud to say, that I think the Afrikaner community has become a very good example of that. And we were sort of forced into that position because we've been so neglected by the government, used as a scapegoat for everything that's wrong with the country. We had no other choice than to become Tocquevillian or to perish. And I think there's some lessons that I think much of the rest of the world can learn from what we're doing, especially in the North, where people still believe the be-all and end-all of problems and solutions are elections. And we've gotten to the point where we think elections are certainly not irrelevant, but it's not the most important thing. You should vote in elections, but But there are more important things than voting, and that's being involved with your community and being involved with practical, tangible solutions.
I guess the problem of that is that you do have a central authority that imposes taxes like VAT, and it's very hard to avoid being drawn into that net unless you take a very strong view, which could land you in prison by not paying your taxes. So how do you address that conflict?
Well, this is something we discussed on during my interview with Tucker Carlson. Is this bizarre situation we've reached as far as tax is concerned. Firstly, the tax system in South Africa is very skewed. The numbers I gave during that interview is in America, it's already a skewed system. In America, 85% of income tax is paid by 10% of the population, so 1 in 10. In South Africa, 85% of income tax is paid by 1 in 30 people. And then on top of that, we have the social grant system with about half the country getting social grants and more than half either getting grants or being paid by the government, in other words, being employees and so forth. So we have a very skewed system as far as tax is concerned. And then your tax money also goes to funding these programs that aim to discriminate against you, to setting up, for example, this blacks-only fund that the government is now doing, or helping the government push expropriation without compensation, or NHI, and so forth. And then after your tax money, your own money is spent on funding programs that aim to discriminate against you, you have to use the money that is left to do the things that the government was supposed to do in the first place, by making sure that you are safe, that your life is protected, that your liberties are protected, and that your property is protected. So it is a very skewed system. And yes, there are a lot of talks about tax revolt. It's a dangerous game, because if you call for a tax revolt, you could end up in prison. And the people who participate in this could also end up in prison or be prosecuted in some way. But I do think there are ways that are also legal ways in which we can be involved with civil disobedience. The e-toll system was one example. No one went to prison or to jail for that. But as a result of the civil disobedience, the system came down. And I think there are ways in which we haven't spent enough time talking about what we might call tax protest, if we don't want to call it tax revolt. I think there are still a lot of things that we can do with our tax money to put pressure on the South African government.
I'd like to get your insights now on the current South African political system. We did talk over when we saw each other in London about the looming election for the leader of the Freedom Front Plus, which Julie went to Corné Mulder unopposed. Is likely to take the party in a different route. When I spoke to him, I asked him, do you know what Ernst is going to be doing? Because in fact, just after I saw you in London, you resigned from your organization that you'd served for nearly 20 years. So are you seeing, when we look at the Corné Mulder impact on Freedom Front Plus on the one side, and then on the other side, the role that the Democratic Alliance is playing in this government of national unity, which some people are now interpreting as appeasement and actually keeping the ANC in power, in continuing along lines that are discriminatory and are hurting the very same people who voted for the DA in the first place? I'd love to just get your insights on all of that.
Yes. So on my own podcast, on my YouTube channel, I recently spoke with Helen Ziller and about whether the Government of National Unity or the GNU would succeed. And I thought it was a fascinating conversation, and she's very well informed and very strategic. I do get the impression, listening to the leaders in the DA, that there's not a cohesive whole when you think about the DA, that different leaders say different things. And depending on who you speak with, that would determine the impression you get of the party. But what doesn't make sense to me, and perhaps this very smart strategy would be revealed that I just don't see, is for me, when the Government of National Unity was formed, it was quite obvious, once again, because of some of the issues we've mentioned earlier, that it's not going to be a long-term solution, that there's going to be some excitement about the GNU, about the fact that the ANC has less power. But somewhere down the line, within a few months or year or a few years, I think at the longest, people are going to become angry with the GNU and become disillusioned with the GNU, and they're going to start seeing the GNU as the problem. And what I don't understand, what I don't think was wise, was the extent to which the DA positioned themselves as, you could say, the champions of the GNU, and trying to be the, you might even say, the leaders, or playing a very significant role within the GNU. I think the parties that are currently in the GNU are going to have some real difficulties when it comes to the next election, because people are going to see them as part of the problem. People are not going to see them as part of the solution unless they really do something. And I think that's already happening. That's my perception. I think that's already happening with the DA, that a lot of people are feeling that, well, the DA has now become part of the problem. And I think one of the things that the DA is considering, and I'm not in the DA, so I'm speaking as an outside observer, and borrowing a bit from what Helen Ziller said to me during the interview, is that one aspect of the political system or situation is the policy framework. In other words, laws such as expropriation without compensation, the Bella Act, national health insurance, and so forth. And another aspect is efficient governance. And I think the DA's line is that they cannot do much about the policy framework because they don't have enough votes. They're not the ruling party, but they can do something about efficient governance. So they can make sure that Home Affairs is run efficiently, that the passport backlog and the ID backlog is corrected, and so forth. And I think to an extent that's working. I think the not just the DA, but the departments that are run by opposition parties are generally better run than those run by the ANC, including, for example, Correctional Services with Pieter Groenewald and Arts and Culture with Gayton McKenzie. But I think when it comes to elections, I think the threat of expropriation without compensation or NHI, these type of things, in other words, the policy framework carries much more weight than the efficiency of the Department of Home Affairs. So if we get passports quicker, but we have expropriation without compensation, it's going to be a problem. People would rather have a dysfunctional Home Affairs office, but not expropriation without compensation. And I think this is something that the parties within the government of national unity need to be very cautious of.
Cornel Mulder has got a big opportunity, clearly, given what you've just outlined and what is common cause, that many people are unhappy with the government of national unity and indeed will become growing or increasingly unhappy as we go forward. Your focus or your prediction on whether he will keep the Freedom Front Plus in that GNU?
Well, if I had to predict based on, again, and I'm not in the Freedom Front, so as an outsider, outside observer, based on what I know and what I think I know of the Freedom Front, if I had to predict, I would say that they're not going to leave the GNU. They're going to stay. But my opinion is I think they should seriously consider leaving the GNU. I think strategically it's going to be a very wise move for the Freedom Front, because I think they would be able to leave the GNU with much less criticism or pushback than the DA, for example. And the benefits that they would reap from that as a party would be significant. So I think they should seriously consider that. Now, of course, if you are in the party and you are in the leadership structures, you can see a bunch of variables that you have to consider that perhaps I'm not considering. But and from the conversations I've had with people who are very in tune with politics in South Africa and whose opinions I generally trust, I increasingly hear people say that they don't understand why the Freedom Front is still in the GNU, and that they don't see much pushback or fallout for the Freedom Front if they leave, but they see massive benefits for them if they do that.
We've had a very civil and very interesting conversation, but at the heart, you remind me of what Steve Jobs did in 1997. You might recall that he started Apple, he was kicked out, he came back into Apple, and he wanted to articulate to the world his vision. And he said this: here's to the crazy ones, the misfits, the rebels, the troublemakers. And at the end of the quote, he says, because people who are crazy enough to think they can change the world are the ones that do. Now, when you look at Ernst Roots and the lightning rod that you've become, the polarized kind of figure that you've become in South Africa, You're certainly one of the crazy ones, the troublemakers, the misfits. How are you going to change the world? I mean, where do we go from here? And there's a lot of pressure that's building in South Africa and internationally. All the engagement, the interview you had with Tucker Carlson, the engagement that AfriForum and Co. have had in the United States with representatives of the people over there. How does this all play out?
Well, let me start by answering with another reference to Steve Jobs from that era when he came back to Apple. And it's something that happened at a board meeting of Apple when Steve Jobs was just back as an advisor and not before he became the CEO, which was that the CEO at the time, Jill Emilio, I think, made a remark about Apple, and he said that Apple is like a sinking ship. They were on the verge of bankruptcy. I think they were 90 days away from filing for bankruptcy. He said, Apple is like a sinking ship, and it's my job to make sure that everyone rows in the right direction. And then someone in the meeting put up his hand and said, well, if we row in the right direction, what about the hole? And that's something that Steve Jobs found very, very amusing. And I think that's very relevant to our situation. The problem with South Africa and the political system in South Africa is first and foremost that we are heading in the wrong direction. But, and this is something I said in my announcement video of my new initiative, which will be published soon, the fact that the ship is heading in the wrong direction has become less important than the fact that the ship is sinking. So we're heading in the wrong direction and we're sinking as well. And I think we need to turn the ship around. We need to fix the hole and turn the ship around. And when I say the wrong direction, I mean the policy ideas that the government is trying to implement. And when I say sinking, I mean the collapse of our government departments and service delivery and so forth. And so if the question is about my role and future, I'm very excited about this new initiative that I'm going to launch in a few days. So excited that I can only tell you, as far as my role is concerned, I'm going to put my foot on the accelerator. I'm going to have much less resources than I had with AfriForum and Solidarity. So there are certainly some disadvantages. I'm going to ask people to support what I'm about to do by contributing if they support this. But I think I'm going to have much more room to maneuver. And I'm going to be much more vocal. So I'm certainly going to be a much more active role player than I was for the last few years. Even though I have been an active role player, I think I'm going to do much more in the years to follow.
But what's the end game? What's the consequence of this?
Well, the end game is, I'm hesitant to say what the end game is because there could be different potential end games. The people of South Tyrol, for example, wanted secession. But they got an autonomous province, and which solved many of their problems. So the end game to me is a general direction at this stage. I think at the point we are in now is the end game is a general direction that could lead to different outcomes as opposed to choosing one particular outcome. And this general direction is a political system in South Africa that is significantly decentralized, where in as far if there is a president, the president must have much less power or authority. Local communities must have much more power or authority. Or the stronger word that I would use is self-governance. There must be much more self-governance in South Africa. And as I mentioned, that could take different forms. The end game could be something like an autonomous provinces. It could be balkanization. It could be a federation. But I'm also the second reason why I'm hesitant to talk about an end game is because there are no final solutions in politics. So I think we can move in a particular direction, which could make things better, only to discover that we are confronted with new problems. But I do think, broadly speaking, the general direction should be decentralization, autonomy, self-governance, as opposed to centralization, government dependency, and waiting for the government to solve our problems on our behalf.
I'm sure there are many people who are participating in this conversation who are saying, yes, I absolutely agree with you. But the other side is that you do have the politics of power. And those who have power at the moment, and you could call it the government of national unity, it's not just the ANC. We know the ANC is losing popularity, but the government of national unity does not appear anyway to willingly want to give up what it currently has to go towards that future system. So what might the catalyst be?
Well, let me steelman that by saying that one researcher in Washington recently commented about South Africa, saying that he's concerned that the ANC is looking towards their friends in Zimbabwe at ZANU-PF, and they saw that even as the country collapsed and the economy collapsed, those in power were able to become stronger. They were able to entrench their position. So I think there are people in the ANC thinking or considering that even if there's a crash and burn scenario, that might just lead to them having more power compared to the loss of power that the people would have. Now, if the question is to what extent would they be willing to give up power, that's highly, highly unfathomable. I think we can use the former government, the apartheid government or the white minority government as an example. It was back in the 60s or 70s, completely out of almost anyone's frame of reference that the National Party government would give up power. And in a sense, they were much more efficient than the ANC government. And in a sense, they were much more stronger, at least in terms of having a much stronger military and police and so forth. But I think the ANC at the time were able to do a SWOT analysis to see what are their strengths and weaknesses and risks and opportunities and or threats and opportunities. And I think we can do the same. There were certain strengths that the white minority government had that the ANC government doesn't have. It's, again, such as a strong military and a strong defense force. But then there are certain strengths that the ANC has that the former government didn't have, such as at least the moral claim of being a democracy, even though that's debatable whether South Africa is a democracy. But I do think that within the bigger scheme of things, if we draw up a proper SWOT analysis of where we are, what our strengths and weaknesses are, where the government is, what their strengths and weaknesses are, I think we will be able to identify certain points of leverage that we might be able to use to push for some form of political change or dispensational change. And when I say political change, I don't just mean getting another party in power, but having again, as I mentioned earlier, a much more decentralized political system.
Many parallels with the old system, and many parallels as well in the way that you and others have been going into the international community as the ANC did during the apartheid years. But what brought down the apartheid government?
Yeah, well, that's a good question.
Yeah,
it wasn't the ANC as much as they would like to claim victory for ending apartheid. The straw that broke the camel's back was the actions by Chase Manhattan in America when they said that they're not going to renew the loans to the South African government. But that in isolation would not have meant much. So there were various factors coming together, international pressure, sanctions. The ANC actively called for sanctions, which is something that the Solidarity Movement is not doing, even though they accused them of such. So there were sanctions, there was economic pressure, there was significant international political pressure, also the fall of the Berlin Wall, the end of the Cold War, and another aspect that I don't see in the ANC currently is that if W. de Klerk, as much as you want to criticize him for what he did and how he approached things and so forth, he had a very, very strong sense of morality or moral conviction. And what I mean by that is he continually spoke of the question, what is the moral thing to do? To the extent that he was criticized by people like Herman Chilumio, who said, yes, you must think about the moral thing to do, but you must also think about power dynamics, which the criticism was that he didn't think about power dynamics. He only asked himself, what's the moral thing? But there are certainly some differences. And I think the short answer to the question, what brought down the apartheid system, is it's a variety of factors, including change of heart within the government, including local pressure within South Africa, including international pressure, including economic factors. And I think if we're going to have change in South Africa, I don't even want to say if we're going to have change, because we are going to have change. Things might become worse or they might become better. But when that change happens, it would also be as a result of a variety of factors. And I think what we need to focus on now is what are the factors that could help applying pressure to ensure that when change happens, it's change for the better and not change for the worse.
Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times. My goodness, we are living in interesting times indeed.
We are certainly in interesting times.
Dr. Ernst Roets, social activist, author, and the man who's going to be starting his own initiative, which I'm sure we will be hearing more of soon. Stacter, with the feedback from your interview with Tucker Carlson, which looks like it's going to be something else into this mosaic that we have in the South African political system at the moment. But it's been lovely talking with you. Thank you for your time. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.